Plans to get connected with 250 agents, managers, promoters, record labels, and other delegates in the industry conference and take your career to the next level.
Submissions are only accepted online and only through Sonic Bids.
Visit nxne.com for details on how to submit your application.
Submissions close January 31st.
Do you ever make up a dance and stomp your feet or punch an old pillow? Or do you have a loud song that you can sing when you're angry? Here's some loud music which just sounds like it's saying, I'm angry. I'm very, very angry.
Good evening and welcome to the January 30th edition of Equalizing the Stort. You're listening to CIET, and it's the punk show. We started off with a band called Simply Saucer from Hamilton, and we heard a song called She's a Dog, one of their first single recorded a long time ago. We've got somebody in the know about this, Gary Gold, who's joining us tonight, and welcome to the show, Gary.
Gary Piggold.
Oh,
did
I think
you
we
say
could...
the January 31st show?
Yes.
It's the 30th.
I don't know. It's one of those days. At the end of the month. I think I need to get you to switch a microphone.
Yeah, I didn't hear anything.
No?
There you go.
That's the one that works. Excellent.
All right.
We had that same problem last week where Ed and I were talking and no one could hear us.
Yep. Anyway. You got to turn up the red one.
Yeah, that's right. So where does the name Pig come from?
Oh,
I know it has its own story, but
it does have a. Would you like to hear it?
Yes, I will.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
I was a student filmmaker in Poor Credit Secondary School, and I made a mockumentary about Poor Credit, the town. It won a film award. It was picked up to be shown on a PBS station. This is way back in the 1930s or so.
That's pretty amazing unto itself. Right?
Exactly, and it was color and audio too, sound, full sound film. Anyways.
I think it's amazing that you got picked up on PBS.
Yeah, that was really amazing. It surprised me most of all. But what they said was there's some possibly inflammatory material in this film, so to indemnify yourself and the high school, you have to credit the film to an imaginary production company, which meant reshooting the titles, which meant I had to come up with an imaginary production company. the day we were about to shoot the titles for the new titles for the film, I was eating breakfast. A little round pig animal stamper came out of the breakfast box. Pig. Alliteration Productions, Pig Productions. So I became Gary Pig long before P-Rock. This is way back in the old days. But when it came time to write this kind of stuff, I already had a cool punk rock name, Gary Pig.
That's right, your own pseudonym.
Yeah, so that's where the pig came from. And again, I needed another P, so pig paper.
Yeah, okay.
See, it's everything makes perfect sense.
Yeah, it's great alliteration. So how did you first get into the punk scene? Because initially, I was looking at your website, and there's a lot of amazing stuff in there. But, I mean, you were first checking out shows. Like, you got to see Hendrix a few times and things like
just
that.
Just once. I think he died right after.
Yeah.
Had nothing to do with me. But, yeah, that was my first concert. I had to sneak in to see them. So he got busted coming into Toronto that day. So it wasn't that great of a show, but I liked it.
Yeah.
You know, it was fun.
Well, especially being a fan, you were talking about writing, doing charcoal drawings of
yeah.
and stuff. When
yeah, you did read my stuff, didn't
yes,
you?
Yes, I did. Sorry.
So that's okay. I was sort of like, this will key into what we're going to be talking about tonight. I just, you know, I was frustrated, bored, you know, stuff wasn't happening. So I just made drawings, made up magazines, made up films, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
That's just what I do.
Yeah, okay.
I make stuff up.
Okay, well, how did you first get into the punk scene?
Well,
like, what was your first point of entry?
What would you define as the punk scene?
I guess the scene that wasn't yet called punk.
Well, that came from just hanging out at the Beverly Tavern and seeing bands like The Dishes playing there. And again, this is before anyone called it punk rock. It was just like bands playing their own material in Toronto in the mid-70s. That was a big deal.
Yeah.
So, again, I wouldn't want to hang out and see a bar band play, you know, the hits of the day. That gets boring. But there is this little hangout called the Beverly where you could see weird bands play. And this would have been 75, 76.
Right, okay.
Again, no one put the P word to it. I remember, you know, when the Ramones first arose, they weren't called punk rock. You know, I think these titles were applied
later on,
right.
Yeah.
So in answer to your question, I don't think I entered the punk scene. The punk scene just formed around people like us.
Okay. Where did you grow up? Were you from Hamilton or Mississauga?
Mississauga.
Okay, so... was there anything happening in Mississauga at the time?
Nothing.
So you mostly came downtown.
Right. And the original Pig Papers, to get on that, if you want to talk about that, now that began just as correspondence between me and my friend Doug in the summers. And he worked at a day camp, and he would say, is there anything on the radio? And I would go, no. And I was getting into used, they weren't even used record stores in those days. They were junk stores where people were getting rid of their 60s albums.
Okay.
This is early 70s. And I would go, oh, yeah, I found a Swinging Blue Jeans album. So I'd write a letter to Doug, call it a pig paper, send it to him, and that's how that began.
Okay. So it was just really correspondence, pen pal talking about music mostly.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And again, this is 71, 72.
Okay. When did you first make an official issue?
The first pig paper was December of 1975, sold as a pretend program. Again, like a mockumentary, now it's a mock program.
Right, right.
For The Who, because John Pinto, who became Johnny Pig, my photographer, and I lined up overnight to get tickets to see The who hadn't been to Toronto in years.
Yeah.
And we thought, this is worth camping out in the slush overnight, whatever. And we realized... wow, we went to all that trouble, lined up all night. We got lousy tickets. So he said, we're going to print up a paper and hand it outside the gardens the night of the concert saying how we got screwed out of these tickets.
Oh, okay.
But thanks to John's day job, he had his boss had nice office equipment. Remember IBM Selectric typewriters?
Yeah.
We got to use those. And the little two-sheet thing about being pissed off at the ticket seller turned into like a 24-page mock program on The Who, which we sold outside the gardens until someone threatened to arrest us and sue us. But by then, we'd made $70 or something like that.
Oh,
so
wow.
We went, now we can continue. Every time a cool band comes to Toronto, which wasn't very often in those days, we'll write a little magazine up.
Oh, that's amazing.
And do you want me to tell you another little
Yeah.
Side knock?
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Well, the reason why we were using John's boss's office was because John had a key. He could sneak us up there. His boss, however, came home from a movie or something late one night, saw the light on it in his office, thought he was being robbed. He came upstairs, caught us. I thought I was going to get in trouble and John was going to get fired. And his boss went, "Why have you got pictures of the Who all over the place on my desks?" And we said, "You know who these people are?" And he said, "Yeah, I went to art school in London with that guy, Pete Townsend."
No way.
So that's why John didn't, only did he not get fired, but the guy said, "Yeah, you can stay here and work on your magazine."
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's great.
So we lucked out again there.
Yeah, totally. Did someone actually threaten to take you to see you at the show was at Maple Leaf Gardens, wasn't
mm-hmm.
it? Did someone actually try and threaten you and stuff about the program?
Yeah, as I was saying outside, because it's like we weren't allowed to sell those things, and we didn't know we weren't allowed to do it. And supposedly, even in those days, you needed permission to sell stuff outside Maple Leaf Gardens. And
really?
This was designed to look like an official something program. That the Who or MCA Records had put out.
Yeah, the cover looks amazing on it.
Yeah, and we had to do that because we thought if it's really cheesy looking, you know, we're going to get caught right away.
Yeah, yeah.
But they let us stand out there for, like, well through the opening act. Toots and the Maytals were playing.
Oh, Toots and the Maytals from Jamaica. Wow.
Yes, exactly. They were the opening act. So we missed them. So we must have been out there quite a while selling stuff.
That seems like an odd combination of bands.
Yeah.
Okay, well, but it speaks to, like, the idea of a fanzine, right?
Right. And
it's a magazine done by fans. And I think people who don't... People who were probably picking it up didn't care. They were just happy to get something on The Who, weren't they?
Yeah, and again, it looked like a program.
Yeah.
I mean, we had like stuff about each member of the group, but of course it was all made up, and we had a discography at the back, which was all made up. It was fun. And we did sneak a little bit in about, you know, it's not worth lining up overnight. If they come back again, you know, don't bother.
Yeah.
But there was a record store in Toronto called Round Records, run by a friend of John's named Larry, who has since passed away. And he liked it, and he said, "Well, if you have any leftovers, we'll try to sell them in my store."
Oh, that's cool.
And again, people said, "Well, is there going to be another issue?" And we said, "Well, it's not really a magazine."
Yeah.
And Larry said, "Well, maybe it should be."
And that led to you putting them out more regularly?
Yes, in April 77, the next cool band came to Toronto was the Kinks.
Okay.
And that leads into my meeting Simply Saucer.
Okay.
Again.
Well, was that the second issue, though, or was there... Because I was looking at something online, and it looks like there's an explanation of the Who issue as the second issue.
Yeah, the second issue, the Who did come back in October of 76, about 10 months later, and actually I think that was the last time you could buy a ticket to see the Who with Keith Moon in the group. That was his last like public show. There was a private one later for a film or something, for Kids Are All Right, documentary in 78.
Right.
But this was the end of the Who's last tour with the original four guys, not that we knew at the time.
Yeah.
So we ran off some extras of the original issue, but we inserted an update inside, and that was Who 2.
Okay.
Which was the second pig paper.
The third issue, then, is about the Kinks?
Right.
Okay. And there was a story in the Treat Me Like Dirt magazine where...
Book.
The book. where Edgar is... goes and hangs off of the singer. Is that right?
Yeah.
Was that around the same time that the...
Yeah. We were going to make another mock program up for the Kinks show, but we knew even then that the Kinks had these guys. They were followers, like Kinks cultists, they were called. This would have been like Deadheads only for a good band.
Yeah, okay.
So there were these people, and we knew a lot of them even around Toronto that were really into the Kinks. Which, again, is very unusual in the mid-70s in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
A Kinks person, you'd meet one or two in each town. So we decided we'll go out and interview these people rather than make up our own thing. We'll interview people about why do you like the Kinks.
Yeah, yeah.
John Pinto, again, was at the 3D concert at the Ontario College of Art, which was the Dishes, the Doncasters, and the Diodes. The Doncasters played I'm Not Like Everybody Else, which is a great Kinks B-side. Edgar Breaux was sitting in the row in front of John and said, oh, I really like that song. And John tapped him on the shoulder and said, you like the Kinks? You know, a friend of mine is doing a magazine on them. Maybe you'd like to be interviewed for it. And that's how we ended up going out to see Edgar.
Well, that's a great idea for a fanzine, though, to try and, if you can't get the band, you can talk the obsession or fascination with the band and, you know, by fans who try to express what makes the band so good. I mean,
right.
In some ways, it's almost a better idea than a review or
I think so. Like, but again, I mean, if we couldn't get hold of The Who, that didn't stop us. We made up interviews with The Who.
Yeah, okay.
But we found in the Kings case, the fans were as, if not more, interesting than the band.
Okay.
Members themselves.
So you were telling me before the show that Freddie Pompei got the idea of the zine, and he called it a science fiction magazine.
Yeah.
Where does the idea of making up interviews come from?
From Cream magazine.
Okay.
From Vintage Cream, which again was about the only magazine, in my opinion, worth reading on rock and roll at that point. And they were very funny. You would be able to glean information, and their information was accurate, but at least a good third of their stuff was funny. It was like rock and roll. It was funny. It was irreverent. It was silly.
Yeah.
So the photo captions would usually have nothing to do whatsoever with this photo subject.
Yeah.
Okay. And they would review non-existent records, and that just, I thought that if I can do a magazine someday, this would be the kind of magazine I would do. And it was, yeah. And I did.
Okay. Issue 4. Was missing on your fan and your website.
I don't know what happened to that.
Do you know what was in the issue?
I have no idea. I know that by the time the fifth one came along, by now we have what may be called a punk rock scene starting here in Toronto. So there were 7 inches. Now I could write about cool new bands. I didn't have to go retread cool old bands.
Can I go back for a second? Can we talk about...
All the way back there?
No.
You have to go within 2 to 6... 6 inches of the mic, you know, not too
yes.
far back.
There's something I was wanting to ask you about. There's a story in Treat Me Like Dirt where Edgar's hanging off the singers. Can you tell me that story about what happened? This was at that show?
No, the Kinks did their concert April 77. We handed out, again, this was just 2 pages. By now, John didn't have that job or office.
Okay.
No more typewriters. So we had to make it up ourselves. We could only afford to do like a 2-page thing. We handed them out for free at the concert. We were planning to go to Buffalo to see the Kinks the next night because the Kinks would always tour Buffalo. Mm-hmm. And most of the Kink cultists would go all the way down there to see them,
yeah.
Which we did. Edgar is one of those people, Edgar Breaux.
Okay.
So, of course, we end up early. We're in the alleyway. This is our third or fourth tour. We'd followed the Kinks in Buffalo. We knew where to go. We knew where the back entrance was. We knew when the sound check was going to be. We knew who to be nice to hold the door open for us. So we were back there in the alley, and Ray Davies' car pulled up, and of course, Ray being Ray, very theatrical, he made a point of not rushing through the door so he could be photographed and like fawned over. And Edgar, I knew, anyone who reads Pig Paper No. 3 knows that Edgar was a real fanatic for the Kinks.
Okay.
And this was the first time he'd ever actually met his idol. So I looked at Ray, and I looked at Ed, and I looked at Ed looking at Ray, and I looked at Ray looking at Ed, being confused, and Ed is about half the height of Ray.
Yes, yeah.
And then I saw Ed scrunching down, and I went, is he going to take a dump on the ground? Is he going to do whatever? And he just leapt straight up onto Ray, clung to his neck for a minute. The rest of us were just standing there cheering, and Ray now decided, I guess it's time to go inside. And he sort of shook Ed loose, and Ed wiggled down to the floor, and the street, I should say, and just lay there for a few minutes.
Wow.
And to me, that is not only Edgar, but that's Hamilton.
That's Hamilton?
Yeah.
Why is that Hamilton?
They just they don't mess around.
Oh, okay. I get it. Yeah, for sure.
Which was reflected in the music, right?
Yeah, for sure. Okay.
So if you're from Hamilton and you're going to see Ray Davies and you've been following the Kinks for 10 years at that point, you're not going to ask for an autograph. You're going to jump on him.
Right.
Makes sense.
Yeah, and yeah, make an impression on the guy who you worship kind of.
Exactly. Thing. He wanted to be closer to Ray.
Yeah.
And for about 30 seconds he was.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Very close.
Okay, so issue 5 comes out in August 77, and it looks to be a punk scene. And
right.
It features on the cover New Wave News. Mm-hmm. And there's pieces, there's a mention of Simply Saucer, The Saints, Teenage mm-hmm. Head, The Battered Wives, The Curse, The Sex Pistols, and The Violetones. So is this the first time that you started covering the local punk scene?
Yes.
And I guess the international punk scene?
Yeah, I was starting to get... I know I had been in London in the summer of 75, and the first night I was there, I went to see the Troggs. The opening act was the 101ers.
Oh, yeah.
I was impressed because they were playing a lot of the songs my basement band, Martin and the E-Chords, Martin who let us in tonight.
Yes, okay.
Martin and the E-Chords. And I went, well, I got to go up and talk to this guy I figured is obviously the leader of the 101ers. It was Joe Strummer. So he was a fan as well, and I recognized, you know, he's crazy like me and like all of my friends. So he said, you know, if I ever get my thing going, you know, recording, you know, I'll send you a copy. And the first Keys to Your Heart, the first 101ers single, he did send to me.
Oh, wow.
So if that's not in that Pig Paper number 5, it should be.
Okay.
So in other words, by the records I collected at this point, the Dishes also were, by this point, hanging out at the Beverly. They had actually pressed a 7-inch at this point. And Amontz Crummins, a very popular man who invented the internet, which meant he had a car so he could drive the Hamilton bands to Toronto. He would always, to this day, he still has a great selection of music in the trunk of his car.
Yeah.
So one day at the Beverly, he said, yo, like this, it's the Saints. It's this great band from Australia. I think they'll write about them in your crummy zine if you want. And that was I'm Stranded.
Okay.
A great, great record, right?
Yeah.
So by the summer of 77, I had cool new stuff to write about, in other words.
Okay, which then prompted an issue.
And yes, and some local bands. I mean, the Vileplumes had been playing. The Crash and Burn had already, probably already closed by then.
Okay.
David's would have been going by that point.
Right, right.
But again, you know, it's not like a blog. We're spoiled nowadays. You can see something right about the next day. It took me months to accumulate enough stuff to fill a magazine and then go to the print shop and then go up and down Yonge Street with my buggy and try to get people to take them. So.
Yeah, yeah. No, I understand. I understand. What was New Wave News? Was it little updates?
Alliteration. It's the N and the N again. That's all it was.
Yeah, but was it updates or was there actually stories? Or
there were little updates at the beginning, but again, by the time in those days, by the time something was printed, especially with a scene as like ever-changing as this, the bands would have broken up or whatever at that point. So I was trying to keep on top of as much stuff as I could at the time. But again, it took at least a month to get an issue compiled and out. And by then...
But
even in those days, it's hard to remember. The Crash and Burn was 6-8 weeks.
Yeah.
Gone.
Yeah.
So the scene was like evolving, which was healthy for it. I look back in retrospect. Everyone was being kicked out of clubs, kicked out of rehearsal places, so you really had to be dedicated to stay at it. But not only that, it was like a slumber party, a rotating slumber party. You had to like move around and try to keep track. So we all, I don't profess to know everything that went on then, but I was just reporting what was going on.
Yeah,
in my little corner of the scene as it moved around.
Right, okay. The issue 6 had an interview with the Talking Heads in it. Was there an interview? And was it from the show that they did at OCA?
That was I think that was a review. I'm not sure if it was like an interview.
Okay. Okay.
I think, was that the Dennis Wilson one as well? Or is that the next one? You've got them up in front of you on the screen.
No, I don't have them up in front of me. I have questions up in front of me.
Okay.
Sorry. I think issue 6 had pieces on Iggy Pop, The Loved Ones, The Vileplumes, The Concords, The Sex Pistols, Simply Saucer, Nick Lowe, The Dishes, Teenage
Oh, yes,
the
Nick
Diodes.
Lowe. He had, yeah, that's something else from Amontz's trunk, right? I do remember that.
Yeah.
Too. Yeah.
Okay, the Ramones, the Battered Wives. And...
Yeah, the Ramones by then had done their second show at the New Yorker. I missed the first one because I was out playing in my bands as well. The second time, not only did I get to see the show, but I got to interview them. So I remember us driving them after, it was Amontz's car again, drove them over to the Crash and Burn. It's a famous night you can read all about in Treat Me Like Dirt.
Hmm. Yeah.
And again, I mean, it was just... I can't emphasize enough, no one, at least I'll speak for myself, it wasn't a scene we were chronicling. We weren't trying to build something in particular. It definitely wasn't called punk per se. The Ramones were just another cool new band. And the first thing I remember Joey Ramone saying to me was how much he liked Herman's Hermits.
Well.
You know, and now you listen to the way his inflection as he sang, yeah, Peter Noone.
Yeah.
So... these were just a bunch of misfits, myself included, you know, record collectors, musicians, and the Ramones were a bit advanced because they'd already been together a couple of years by this point. They'd had two albums out at that point.
Okay. I wanted to ask you about, was New Legion Rock Spectacular, was that a real band? Or was
yep.
That, okay, who?
Yeah, that was a second cousin, and that actually ended up in Teenage Head's repertoire at the time. I was supposed to reissue that record, but I had no idea how to do that at that point.
Okay.
Again, this was a record by now. See, I knew Ira Robbins at Trouser Press. I knew Greg Shaw, who was doing Bomp. These were magazines I had already connected with, again, 75, 76, by going to Toronto record shows. So
was Bomp had Bomp started already by
oh,
then?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Well, Bomp goes, if you trace, there's the there's fanzines right there. I mean, Greg and Crawdaddy, I mean, those were going 66, 67.
Okay.
So those were mimeographed sheets. And when I got hold of Greg and I started sending the pig papers, he goes, yeah, you're doing what I was doing in 66 and what, you know, became the San Francisco scene, Flame and Groovies, for example.
Right. Okay. And Headache, was that a real band?
That's a good question. I may not have written that review. Headache, okay. I don't remember. Oh, wait a minute. There was a band called The Headaches.
The Headaches?
Who hung around Saucer House, Simply Saucer's house. So that might have been, I'm sure they thought they were a real band.
Yeah.
I don't know if they ever played. Saucer, we can talk about later, that house was very important because so many people met there and connected and got together. And Headache or The Headaches could be the same band. They were possibly people, you could also say there were Saucer's road crew at the time, quote unquote.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You were talking about a band that you were in. Was this The Loved Ones that you had?
Yeah, that became The Loved Ones. I was in a pretend band called Martin and the E-Chords, but The Loved Ones was actually Steve Park, who was originally in Simply Saucer. My friend Roy, who I knew through a mutual friend at Sheridan College. Richard Citroen, who later joined the Diodes, was our drummer. It was funny, one of the first times I ever met him, he went, you know, someday I'm going to be the drummer for the Diodes.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and 3 years later he was.
Okay.
So it's not for very long, I don't think, but he was.
Yeah.
And I mention Simon the Singer went on to do one album for Capitol up here, fronting a band called The Start.
No.
Had a song called Hey You, which was a hit in Germany.
Okay.
This would have been 80, 81 by this point.
Okay.
So, yes, that was a real band.
Okay.
And we played, you know, that we rented Wise and I was trying to put shows on in Hamilton. We played the Beverly, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, because I saw a flyer for The Loved Ones with Simply Saucer at the Y.
Yes, that was our first show.
Okay.
It's October 77.
Yeah, okay. And speaking of Germany, I noticed on the pig paper there was there's some German on the top, and then there's also a price for the zine in UK money.
Yeah,
did the zine actually get distributed in Europe?
Yes, through I'd like to say it was Joe Strummer. Someone I was already in touch with said that there's a record store which I'm sure is still there called Rough Trade before it became a distributor and before it became a label.
Right.
So the pig paper was on sale in London. It was on sale in New York. It was on sale in LA at that point. And again, we were connecting with each other, so you sought out certain people in certain towns. And again, Ralph Alfonso can tell you the early Diodes shows, tours he was booking outside of this area was through the fanzine circuit, so they could get down, play Boston, for example, because of Boston Groupie News.
Right, okay.
So I would like send my magazines, they would send me theirs, they would distribute my magazine down there in exchange.
You would do the same.
I would do the same
up here, right. Okay.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. And I remember Blair Martin from Raving Mojos once explaining this as, he talked about the cultural dialogue that would go on between scenes.
Yes.
And fanzines would help with that cultural dialogue. So
fanzines were incredibly important because that was the internet, that was the blog of the day. And again, it wasn't anywhere near as efficient as it is now. As I was saying, the news is old. But it was your only way to get news.
Yeah.
So the only way, there's a great story in the book about Charlotte writing to Cynthia, I think, of the B-Girls, asking how to get a band together.
Oh yeah, Charlotte from the Go-Go's, right?
Right. Yes. Right. So again, their scene was even, you know, now we understand that because there's a book
that explains
about it.
It,
but it was like the LA scene, which has been well documented, was actually a bit behind. They were watching what was going on in Toronto.
Yeah, I found that one that particular story was amazing to me, to situate Toronto as far advanced than you know the LA scene.
Yes, we were being watched, and people were watching. And again, thanks to Liz's book, I mean, it's putting everything in perspective. Not that Toronto was like the be all and end all; it just should get equal credit.
Yeah,
because
sure.
It was important, and the other scenes were definitely watching.
Yeah.
And again, the Ramones had a very early following outside of their little area, like in New York. They were very popular in Toronto.
Yeah, yeah. Well, partially because of proximity, I would imagine, right?
Right. But, yeah. I mean, it took Gary Topp to ask them to come and play here.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Originally, I mean, that was... And we know what happened. You know, all the people who were at that first Ramones show.
Do you know if that would have been the first time the Ramones would have played outside of New York?
No, they played London on the 4th of July of 76.
Okay.
And I could be wrong, but I think that was the night that Joe Strummer broke up the 101ers because he saw the future.
Right.
So he goes, no. And then
he talks about that at the end of the century.
Right. So yeah. I think it was that night. I know it was the 4th of July, and it would have been 76, because they didn't come to Toronto until September of 76.
Okay.
I think that was the first New Yorker show.
So it would have been maybe the second?
Yeah.
The second.
We got to look in the back of On the Road with Ramones, Monty Malnick's book.
Okay.
There's a great list of every gig they played
in
the very beginning.
Wicked.
So.
Okay, so issue 7. I want to get back to the pig paper. Actually, we should break for an ID quickly, and then when we
you
get
need
back,
to see my ID now.
No.
Okay.
This is
station ID.
This is who we are.
Okay. This is CIUT 89.5 FM, the University of Toronto Community Radio Station, available across Canada on Star Choice National Satellite Service, channel 826. And broadcasting worldwide at www.ciut.fm.
And
we're back.
Yes, we're back. You're listening to Equalizing the Start, CIT's weekly hardcore punk show, and we have Gary Pig Gold in from the Pig Paper, and also one of the editors of Treat Me Like Dirt. We're right now talking about the early Pig Papers.
I think we're up to the winter of 77 now.
Yeah, that's right. December 1977. That's amazing that you remember it all.
The covers I remember. I don't remember what was inside, though.
Okay, well, I'm going to... And on the cover of this one, there was a piece on the vibrators from England. Do you remember if that was an interview?
That was a story that John made up.
Okay.
About, but not made up, but it was about they were in trouble, and I don't remember. There's some gang connection, something going on that the vibrators got in trouble over there. John would remember, but it was we made a story.
Okay, and there was also that. Somebody interviewed from Eddie and the Hot Rods.
Yeah, they had played. I think that was at the Masonic Temple too.
Could be. I don't.
I think so. I have the flyer in my basement. I don't have it with me.
Oh, but. Wow. I need to go to your basement.
Yeah, you should.
Okay. Do you know who else might have been in that issue?
I know that, again, I was always conscious of, like, not being strictly... by now, the word punk rock was being used all over the place.
Okay.
And I don't know how I sort of realized this at the time, but I didn't want to get stuck in any particular thing. So my... subject matters would cover the new stuff. It was being called punk now, but still, you know, I had an interview with Dennis Wilson from the Beach Boys, and
yeah,
I called Beach Boys Love You album, which is a great album. I said, this, if you want to call punk, this is a punk album, you know, whatever. It was just went like that.
Yeah. Okay.
Punk is not a music. It's a state of mind.
Right. That's, I mean, I've heard that before and I agree to it. Issue number 8, had an amazing cover. It had Elvis Costello on one side, and I think there was, I can't remember what else was on the other side.
Freddie and Steven, the Violetones.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, the Violetones were on the other side. So it was like Elvis, Violetones, and then there was a whole bunch of other bands like Teenage Head.
Mm-hmm.
That was like a historical re-look back at Teenage Head, I think.
No, I was just, I think they'd had the one single out by now. I knew their manager, Paul Kobach, so he'd been playing me their demos, and again, Amatz, everything comes back to Amatz.
Yeah.
He had a copy of their demo on a cassette, and his car was playing it for everyone.
Right.
The Runaways were in there because I'd seen them at the Alma Combo. By now, the Pig Paper could get us into shows at the Alamo. And John taught me, if you don't have a pig paper handy, just take in a camera and run up the stairs, and they'll assume that you're the official photographer for the event.
Okay.
So, yeah, the Runaways was a great show. By then, that could have been the first tour that Joan was fronting the group, and they were amazing. And if I'm not mistaken, that night, Flo and Eddie got up and did the encore with them, because I think they're in town doing voiceover work.
Oh, wow.
They did Strawberry Shortcake. This might have been a bit late, but they're doing something in Toronto, some voiceover work.
Wow. That's another thing in the Treat Me Like Dirt book, that you're finding out that like lots of musicians were coming to town to record here.
Right. I mean, there is a famous story about Phil Lynott from Thin Lizzy hanging out at the Crash and Burn, and it was only because they were in town recording. And
looking
again,
for something to do afterwards.
Yeah. And again, where do you go to see something good after 8 o'clock and the streetlights go on and everything closes up? Well, there's this incredible place called the Crash and Burn.
Yeah.
So you would end up there only because there's no place else to end up.
Right.
That's why I had to take the Ramones there. They said, where do we go to see stuff? And I said, there's only one place.
Yeah.
But they liked it.
Yeah. Oh, good, good. Also in that issue, there was a piece on the Forgotten Rebels, I think.
Yeah, they had...
And the Diodes.
Yeah, the Diodes I always tried to cover because I wasn't a big fan of the Diodes. I'll be perfectly frank. I wasn't a fan of them on stage, and we'll talk about this later, because I got spoiled by hearing Teenage Head very early on and seeing them in Hamilton, and they had the jump on all the Toronto bands. They had already been together practicing six nights a week.
Mm-hmm.
The Diodes, to me, always made great records. It took them, which it would take any band, a bit longer to get
good
up to Teenage Head level as a live act.
Yeah.
So I'd always try to write about the Diodes records. I liked what they were doing on record right from the beginning.
Right, okay.
I sort of picked up on it because they covered Red Rubber Ball, and they wrote a song about the Buffy from Family Affair committing suicide. So they knew what they were doing.
Yeah, totally. Okay. Then I think you took a break after issue 8 and released a record. Is that right?
Yeah, there could have been a break. I don't think it was too long of a break.
No, probably not.
No.
Because it looks like there's something every month.
I know I had to quit. I realized, or someone probably told me, quit putting the month, the date on the cover to start numbering them like Pig 8, Pig 9, Pig 10. Then you're not specifically stuck in a certain thing, because these didn't have any shelf life. They could sit there until someone bought them.
Sure. But I appreciated that they did have the dates, because then you can, I mean, as an archivist...
Inside they have the dates,
you can,
right.
Yeah, you can kind of figure out, situate them in a period of time, right?
Right, exactly.
Okay, so tell us about...
No, go ahead.
Tell us about how you came about to release a Simply Saucer record, and how long did it take?
Well, we'll jump back briefly to when John and I were told to go out and interview Edgar for the Pig Paper. Now we're jumping back to the...
The Kinks issue?
Yeah, so this would have been... February, March 77, when we were doing the interviews, and Edgar said, come to this house and you can interview me about the Kinks. And now I know that he planned to have his band rehearsing while we were waiting to be let in. So we could, that was, they were playing for us. We didn't know it. I didn't even know he was in a band. I'd never met him. So while we were waiting, we heard this great music, and we could tell it's obviously not a record or a radio. And they came up out of their basement, let us in. We did the interview. And then, as I'm sure Ed planned it this way, I said, was that your band playing downstairs? And he goes, oh, yeah, I have a band. Well, how long have you been together? 3 years. What do you call it? Simply Saucer. Where are you from? We're from here. We're from this house. Oh, well, do you ever play around? He goes, no. I said, maybe you would like to play Toronto? And he went, I don't think we've ever played there before. So the first... So
were you kind of helping them along?
I was helping anyone that I could.
Yeah.
You know, we were all helping each other out.
Were you living in Hamilton at the time, or you just... Because I think there was a period of time where you did live in Hamilton. Is that correct?
Yeah, I ended up there when it was time to make the record. I mean, again, in my band, The Loved Ones, we were rehearsing in Steve Park's basement, and he was in Hamilton.
Right.
So that sort of... I couldn't carry my amp on the GO train. It didn't work after a while. So I ended up in Hamilton, yeah.
Okay. How long did it take this record to come out?
It was pretty fast because there was only two studios that we could get into at that point. Saucer had already recorded with Bob Lanois in 74, I think, and that was in the basement of his parents' house, in the Lanois' house.
Yeah, which is
Ancaster.
Pretty... That was amazing. That was an amazing story in itself.
Yeah, that's a whole other story.
Yeah.
So,
But that wasn't this recording.
Oh, no, no, no. Oh, you mean not the thing that we just heard, but the Cyborgs. Yeah, that's on there, the Cyborgs, like Bulletproof Nothing, etc.
I'm talking about the 7-inch.
No, the 7-inch, by that point, you know, I had, hanging around the Saucer House listening to them play, I thought they had a lot of really good songs, and I'm old school in that respect. I just look for songs. And I realized that Edgar was, you know, he still is a very good writer, had some good songs.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, let's try to put a record out, because 7-inches were starting to come out in those days. I was getting a lot of them in the mail. With those 7-inches, it'd be, well, if you ever know anyone, you know, send their records my way, which I was already trying to do. And I went, well, I'll try to put out a record. So we couldn't get into Grand Avenue Studio, too expensive. So we ended up in a guy's basement. The record had to be done very, very quick because the guy got mad at us and, you guys are too loud, this isn't music, the usual stuff. So he kicked us out, and we had to have everything done by midnight that night. So the record, you know, it was semi-mixed.
Okay.
And
You were telling me that there's some bass missing in...
It's a bit... You can EQ Pro Tool it a bit now, but originally, by the time I found the bass fader... I mean, there was an intern from some recording school sitting there with me. The guy who owned the studio was up watching Hockey Night in Canada.
Because he didn't like the music.
No, and he didn't like us by this point. So he just said, leave the money on the way out. You guys think you know what you're doing, fine, make your own, you know, blank, blank record.
Yeah.
So that was it. So by the time we got to the B-side, I found where the bass fader was. And I said, can we go back and remix it? And he goes, no, it's going to take 3 minutes. It's not enough time. So what little bass there was, leakage, you know, we managed to, like, EQ it back up. There's a bit now, but the single I don't think had much at all.
Okay, well,
it's too bad.
Let's listen to I Can Change My Mind from that single.
And there is bass.
Okay, here we go.
I can change my mind.
And that's a single, I Can Change My Mind. What was the EP was called She's a Dog? Is that
the just right the song? 7-inch, just two songs.
It was just called the 7-inch?
It was so, Simply which, Saucer.
Which was the A-side?
She's a Dog.
Okay.
And that was chosen because we had planned other releases by Saucer. There's going to be two other singles and then an album. But one thing led to another. But She's a Dog, we thought, out of their repertoire at that time, that was the most, I guess you call it commercial. It was the most accessible, I guess. And we'll talk more about this later. They had a hard time fitting into what was now becoming a punk scene in Toronto because they'd already been playing. They had a lot of songs that wouldn't fit in. But they would make a point of playing their shorter songs like the one you just heard. So She's a Dog was the first choice for the first side of the first single because it was their most popular song.
Okay. What happened with the plans to do another single? What happened?
I ended up moving away. Okay. I moved to California. So okay. I never got a chance to do another one. And again, I mean, we're spoiled nowadays where you know...
Do you know
what GarageBand, upload, your record's released. Yeah. In those days, you needed thousands of dollars. It was like a 3-4 month plan. Then you had to mail it around to people and wait. And She's a Dog was single of the week in Record Mirror. And I have no idea how that happened. But suddenly Rough Trade, for example, were saying you should send a lot more records over here right away. And I said, I don't have a lot of records, and I don't have any money to make any more. So no one would have known.
Yeah, yeah.
We were just totally seat of the pants.
That's totally unfortunate.
Yeah. It's whatever. People still like them, so the records got around anyways.
And a record got out, which is nonetheless great.
Yeah, it was hard to put a record out in those days.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, but do you know what the other single might have been?
There was a short list that Edgar had, and we were just sort of figuring out. I mean, by that point, we knew enough that we would go in and record more than just the two songs. And we knew by then never to go back to this guy's basement.
Yeah.
By this point, Teenage Head probably would have been in Grand Avenue. This is the Dave Rave connection. So Dave and his partner, Rick, who were singing backups on the Teenage Head, like Top Down, the single version, okay. That's Rick and Dave.
Yeah.
So they were doing work there. So now there is an inn to Grand Avenue. We wouldn't have to pay the public prices. And right. The studio had just opened. Grand Avenue had just opened. So we could have gone in there, and that would have been really cool because they would have understood. And Dan Lanois, by this point, was producing himself, not just engineering Bob's stuff.
Okay. Was there any other songs recorded with the 7-inch? Or
no.
Just those two songs?
No, and we, again...
That was
would have been nice. We didn't have time to turn the bass up.
Yeah, no, that's what I was figuring. But
we were out by midnight. We had to be out.
Okay.
And we were never getting back in. They hated us.
Yeah, it seemed like it. Even in the book, it seems like the guy just didn't. I mean, he went up to watch hockey. He didn't want to even hear you.
Yeah, I don't know why we went there. I don't know why.
It was probably a cheap place. It was somewhere.
Well, of course.
Else. Mm-hmm. One of the few places you probably knew. So, how did you go? Speaking of knowledge, how did you figure out how to put out a 7-inch? Because I'm imagining back then, even when I got into hardcore, it was a bit of like it was tricky to figure out how to find a pressing plant. But I can only imagine back then, in the late 70s, it would have been how did you find out about how to put out a record?
This would have been late 75, early 76. Again, hanging out at the Beverly, we would have our pretend staff meetings there, the Pig Paper.
Yep.
And the Dishes were usually still playing there every night.
Had their single come out yet?
Well, that's what happened. One night, Stephen Davey handed me this record, and I, you know, opened it excited. Wow, it's a picture covering everything, a cardboard, you know, like the old British, you know, 7-inches that
totally.
I was collecting in the junk stores.
Yeah.
But when I pulled the record out, I saw it didn't say Capitol or Warner's or something on the label. And I said, who put this record out? And they said, well, we did. And how? And he said, you go into a recording studio, you record your songs, they put them on tape, and then you send the tape to this place in Oshawa, I think it was called World Records, you give them some money, and then you go, they phone you, and you come and pick up your records. And this was a revelation. I went, wow, you don't have to be the Beatles or something to put out a record.
Yeah, totally.
And by now, the Vile Tones had Screamin' Fist out, right? That was out. Teenage Head, that's a trickier thing because I think they had some sub-licensing. There's a big legal morass there. But they had single, which they were putting their own picture sleeve on at Star
Records.
Yeah,
they talked about putting them together at Star Records.
Right.
So was it self-released or the Teenage Head single?
No. They had got, again, through Jack Morrow, I think their manager, something was going on through some label, so it slid in under the radar and it got released. But they had to do all the... There was an Epic connection,
because
they did
all the grunt work for it, so...
Yeah.
It sounds like it was a self-release, that's all.
Probably all, except they had a real label on there.
Okay.
But again, World Records, I mean, they would just shove our little pressings of 500, 1,000 records...
In between things.
In between Ann Murray records, because the Saucer record was pressed at Capitol. I knew enough from collecting, there's a little Capitol logo in the runout group. So I knew this wasn't being pressed in this office in Oshawa. It was sent through Capitol. And I found out later that would get billed to Ann Murray's new single. They just run some extras in the middle of the night and, you know, sell them to World, who'd sell them to us.
Well,
that's cool.
Yeah, however it comes out, it comes
out. Yes, exactly. The important thing is it comes out.
Right. Did Pig Records ever release anything else after?
We were in line to do the first Forgotten Rebels record.
That would have been amazing.
Yes, they were an amazing group, again, that were put together sort of as a challenge from me to Mickey, saying they were hanging around the Saucer House all the time.
Right.
Mickey had cool wardrobe.
Yes, he did.
So I walked across, still does.
Yeah.
So I walked across the room and I started talking to him, and his chatter was even cooler than his wardrobe. So, like I said to everyone in those days, I said, well, have you got a band together? I'm thinking of putting one together. And I said, if you get it together, you can open for Simply Saucer. That would be great. And he came back and he actually put a band together. And this really impressed me. I said, this guy's serious.
Yeah.
This guy's cool. So there was going to be, I still have the original flyers, you know, that coming soon on Pig Records. It's supposed to be Pig 2, the second 45. But by then I had moved away from here. And they found Bob Bryden, who took over the project and did a great job with it.
Okay.
And that became the 12-inch.
Right, right.
The first Rebels 12-inch. Yeah. So by that point, you know, it expanded.
Yeah.
They had a budget.
And they did eventually play with Saucer.
They did play with Saucer that night.
And closed the place for them.
They burned a flag on stage, which is the name of their first demo tape, Burn the Flag. And they did burn a flag. And I got sued. Over it.
Yeah, were you the one responsible for booking the show?
Well, of course, when the lawsuit started, I was responsible.
Okay.
But all I'd done was gone in and rent the hall for the night.
Yeah.
But I knew enough not to... I knew from trying to rent apartments, you don't say you're a musician.
Yeah.
So I went to say, I'm putting on a private function.
Yeah.
And it was these two bands.
Was it a veterans hall or...?
YM or YW, one of those CAs in Hamilton. So that didn't last long. So I got a letter in the mail being sued, and which I also have in my basement. You should come. Sometimes it's all down there still.
Did you get sued?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, what happened with it?
I was out of the country,
so
they never found me. But I think it was $200 some odd because someone had torn a door off the washroom. But the main thing I remember from the letter was damage to vegetables. It was $24. So I wasn't aware of any vegetables being, unless they meant human vegetables, or I don't know. But someone got damaged that night, and $24 worth of damage.
That's crazy.
Yeah. It was a great show, though. That's, again, Hamilton folklore, punk lore.
So was that one of the reasons why you got out of the country?
No, I was already planning. Again, all during this time, I had my own band going with the remnants of the loved ones. By now, it's just Roy and I learning how to bounce tracks on a two-track. We removed the race head, so we were doing mono.
Okay.
You know, saturation recording. And Jeremy Gluck, who was I had met him somewhere around years earlier. By now, he was in London forming the Barracudas. He was the British columnist for the Pig paper. He was saying, bring your band over to London. Peter Case I knew because the Nerves had opened the Crash and Burn, and I'd stayed in touch with him. He was putting together what became the Plimsolls. He was saying, come to California, so I went to California.
Okay.
Al was planning on doing that, but the vegetable lawsuit, that sped things up a bit.
Okay.
I will admit.
Yeah. Did you go to L.A. or San Francisco or
somewhere
else?
Roy and I, my guitarist, went down, and we were met at the airport by two girls from Fountain Valley, California, who subscribed to the Pig paper. And they said, where do you want to live? And me being a big Jan and Dean Beach Boys fan, I said, near the beach. They took us to Huntington Beach.
Oh, yeah.
Another cool hardcore scene.
Totally.
Which I, again, I just, that was an accident. I ended up there and had a version of The Loved Ones there from 80 to 83.
Wow.
And played around down there with the Dream Syndicate, you know, the crowd and all these, like, you know, we had a scene down there, what became Paisley Underground, they call it now.
That's amazing.
Yeah, Steve Wynn I knew because Rhino Records, the store, I think it was in Westwood near UCLA. I went in there once. He noticed from my accent because I still had the out and about.
Yes.
So he knew where I was from. And I said, I'm from, you know, Hamilton, Toronto. And he said, oh, have you ever heard of this band called Simply Saucer? And I said, I actually put their record. Oh, I love that record. You know, so that,
yeah.
It, again, I was sending, by the time I got the record done, they were, the records were down in LA too. They were getting around.
So that's, yeah, that's great though.
That was cool.
Yeah.
And I remember, we won't get into the personal gossip, but I remember Steve was going with Susanna Hoffs, who was putting the Bangles together, which became the Bangles. So it was a really cool little scene. And more in line with what I was doing musically. It's now called like power pop, I guess, if you need a pigeonhole. So that scene was coming. Dream Syndicate were more like a saucer type band. The Bangles, you know, were more a commercial type thing.
Okay.
And I'd been in touch with Rodney Bingenheimer as well. We were sending all the Canadian 7-inches down there. He was playing
for a show.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So there's some other issues of the Pig Paper. Like there's one that had John Lydon on it,
mm-hmm.
Issue 9. And was there a story on him?
Yeah, we made up an interview with John Lydon because he was through town. He had an aunt or something around here, and he promised we would get together, and he didn't show up, which didn't bother me, so I just made up an interview.
Okay.
Sent it to him, and again, you know the first Public Image 12-inch, the album?
Yeah.
Everyone tells me that the logo, it's supposed to look like a magazine cover, it's his head and the same typeface that Pig 9 was. It looks like the 9th Pig Paper.
So you think he took the idea from...
I don't know, but that's what everyone
sounds
else
like
says.
Sounds like it, yeah. It totally sounds like it. It looks like it.
But he did get a copy because Virgin now, I was on the mail list because I was getting all the Pistol stuff, so they were sending... They were really trying to promote Public Image, and they were sending me the stuff, and I'd always send, you know, the Pig stuff back. I'd been doing that since XTC. That's right. That's the first Virgin band that you know they were trying to promote through the Pig Paper.
Yeah, I saw that on one of your covers.
Through
actually.
Rough Trade, there was someone from Virgin was buying the stuff at Rough Trade, buying the
right.
Pig Papers.
Yeah, yeah. So did you?
And I don't think would there have been another outlet to review these things around here at that point? Probably not.
So you would have done a piece on XTC as well.
I loved XTC.
They were a great band. Yeah.
The first 12-inch.
Yeah.
Was great.
Okay. Issue 10 has a picture, has a cover of the Dave Clark Band.
The Dave Clark Five, right?
Who were they?
Who were the Dave Clark Five?
Yes.
You don't know who the Dave Clark...
I do not.
Well, someone will call in. No, they were a British invasion band. Glad All Over, Bits and Pieces, Any Way You Want It, which you may know Kiss did a great cover version in the 70s.
Oh, yes. Right? Okay, yeah.
See?
That's right. I do know that song, yeah.
See? So, yeah, they were, again... I thought I'll put them on the cover because I have a big article about the Dave Clark Five, and... I was wondering when I sent that around to all the usual shops what would happen because I'd always have like Buddy Holly or something snuck in the middle of the magazine, but now I'm sticking them on the cover, but it actually was the best-selling issue up to that point.
Mm, okay.
So that was cool.
That came out in December 78, and then there was two issues that came out, 10A and 10B.
Yeah. Now I was trying, there was a lot happening by this point, so I was envisioning putting something out every between issues. So okay. It would take me a long time to assemble these big issues, and then I wanted something just to free something. Or actually, they were a quarter or something. I was trying to put something out more, like a blog.
10A had something on the diodes about, which became a title in the Treat Me Like Dirt book, which...
Everyone uses Tired of Waking Up Fired now,
yeah,
right? But,
yeah, but it looks like it was written in your fanzine first.
Yeah, well, the diodes had just been dropped by CBS at that point, and Ralph was righteously... pissed off about that.
Yeah.
So he was using the media, and he's very good. He still is. You know, he knows how to use the media.
Mm-hmm.
So he knew, even at that point, above and beyond what I knew to do or anyone else I was aware of, you know, he went straight to the papers, and he tried to expose this for what was going on, and as he should have, because they got screwed.
Well, in the book, there's also, he's got up at one of the shows and talked about it too, didn't he?
Right.
He spoke about it.
Yeah, and good for him.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, he should have done that.
Yeah. 10B had a piece on the Ugly Ducklings and the Clash.
Yeah, the Ugly Ducklings, again, a great I guess they'd be called proto-punk if you want to stick a label on them. But they were a great band. And the Loved Ones, for example, one of the first songs we did was Nothing, which was like an early Ugly Ducklings.
Okay.
Ugly Ducklings were Toronto's, probably Canada's answer to the Stones in the 60s. By this point, they were noticing what was going on. They put out Razor Records, which is affiliated with the Ducklings, put out the second Vile Tone 7-inch.
Yeah, that's what I
remember. So they were on the scene. So by now, they actually got back together, and they played a show. I think it was at The Edge. But I couldn't get in. It was sold out, and I couldn't get anywhere near Gary Topp. So I remember I drew a picture of just black, and I went, this is my view of the concert. So I just stood in the doorway and listened. And they were great. And they put out a reunion album at that point. This would have been 79, right? Is that what it says there?
It says, it was early 79.
Okay. And that was a good record because you got to be suspicious when these old bands get back together. But these guys were good. They still had it.
Yeah.
Great band.
So they were responsible partially for the second Vile Tones, right?
Yeah, Razor Records.
Yeah.
Yep.
Amazing.
Oh, they were cool guys, and they could go, Vile Tones, okay, this is sort of what we were trying to do in 66. Same thing.
Wow.
And again, it's easy now to put pigeonholes, but if you want to apply punk, when did the punk scene start? 66 with the Ugly Ducklings. They couldn't find anywhere to stay because their hair was down to here.
Okay.
They didn't do that back in those days.
Yeah, totally.
Punks. They were punks.
Okay, issue 11 had a picture of Elvis on it. Was that around when he passed away? It came out in January 1980.
He was worm food by this point, dead.
Yeah. So was that the idea? Was it? Was it a piece on Elvis? Was there a big?
They
piece
were.
On
it
Elvis
was time or? To. It was probably the first wave of tell-all books like Trash Press, which is everywhere now. But they were really knocking Elvis. And Stephen Leckie can tell you about this, too. If you want to, Elvis was amazing. That's a whole other show. But I was getting, on my way, I went, enough on Elvis. I'm going to do my little part to say, look, the guy was great.
Hmm.
He had some bad shows, especially at the end, and he sort of screwed up, right? But,
that
he was amazing. So I wrote a little thing about Elvis.
I had some friends tell me about that. There were some issues that were called pocket pig issues.
That was the first one.
Yeah. My friend was telling me that he loved that one. He still has that.
Does he?
Yeah. And it was an unusual size. Can you describe how it was folded? And
it's basically regular.
Eight and a half
I can't remember. Yeah, but it would have been chopped in half so you would fold it. So, again, you could get double the press run.
Was it the 5.5 size or was it like the 8.5? Tall.
8.5 tall.
Yeah.
So you would say, again, alliteration pocket pig.
Yeah, because the cover was like really long. That's why I was looking at it going.
So that was to double the press run for the same money, and all we had to do is give them a bit extra money to chop them in half.
Okay.
And it's the collating, I think it's called, was extra, because now you get two sets of staples.
Right, yeah. To keep it together.
Right. And my writing got much smaller, of course, to fit.
Yeah, because it's like almost the column, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's nothing compared to CD liner notes. It's much bigger than that.
Yeah. Well, good. At least you can read it.
Yep.
Okay, so would that have been the first Pocket Pig issue?
Yeah, that was the first one. I think at this point I'd already been down to L.A. on a reconnaissance mission. I liked Huntington Beach, so I was definitely planning on going back, which I did. So I managed to get a couple of this and the next one, the John Lennon issue, out before I actually moved away.
Was that the issue 12?
The one with John Lennon on the... Yeah, if Elvis was 11, John would have been 12.
Okay.
And again, the reason for that was because everyone was wondering whatever happened to John Lennon and bagging on him, because he'd been gone for 5 years at that point, which in today's years would have been 20.
Yeah.
For someone not to record. So everyone was going, he's dead, his hair's fallen out, he's a heroin addict, or whatever. So I just, again, tried to get people focused, whatever, but, he was great music.
Yeah.
Do you remember Rock and Roll Radio, right? It's name checked on there, so it's enough.
Yeah, for sure. Do you recall who was in issues 13 and 14? Because I couldn't find them on the...
13 was a press issue, which was my press clippings. For Now I've Moved to L.A. 14 was an issue I did in L.A. about Jerry Lee Lewis. Because there was a... Yeah, just because I like Jerry Lee Lewis. Same sort of thing. So we did an issue on Jerry Lee Lewis.
It's good that you did theme issues on people you liked.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's...
It's better than doing issues with people you don't like, right?
Yeah, totally. Through 1985, it looked like the zine came out every month as a one-pager. Is that what happened?
Yeah.
And were you living out in California?
I lived in California from 80 to 83.
Okay.
And then I was living in Vancouver for a while. And then I came back to Toronto in 85, I believe it was, and was reconnecting. I'd been gone at this point for 5 years, so I was reconnecting with a lot of people. And the scene had totally changed by this point, obviously. By now you had Blue Rodeo coming up, Handsome Ned, et cetera, et cetera. So you had a different scene here in Toronto at that point.
Okay. How come you were coming out every... In 85, were you back in Toronto? Or?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so... You moved back to a one page zine? Is that
yeah? Now,
is that it, that was so you could come out every month?
Yeah, and also by this point, I was trying to get a Toronto version of the Loved Ones together again. Put an ad in the Star asking for people who could sing harmonies, and I got invited to audition for a Beach Boys tribute band. Here's a little secret, and that was going to be my summer job. It was a band called Endless Summer. And I thought, this is a way to make a whole lot
that's
of money,
Endless Summer
having
was.
A lot of fun.
Yeah.
Right. But that turned into like a full-time occupation. So we were booked through. I remember we had the same agent that was booking Teenage Head at the time. So we were on a really cool circuit. And I went, you know, this is a lot of fun. I like the Beach Boys. There's worse things you could be doing for a living, right?
Yeah.
And we're playing a lot of cool outdoor gigs and, you know, having a ball, having a lot of fun and making a ton of money.
You had a piece in one of your issues on Brian Wilson, didn't you?
Yeah, I'd always been a big... fan
Beach
of
Boys
his,
fans, yeah. Okay.
I make no apologies.
Not asking for any. it looks like then you just got immersed in doing music at that point.
Yeah.
It seems like the pig paper dropped off.
Yeah, because by the end of my Endless Summer run, the Beach Boys had a record called Kokomo, and I went, that's it for me. I mean, I'm going to be doing this the rest of my life because now they've had another hit, which they're going to milk, which means we're going to have to milk for another 5 years, and I went, enough already.
Mm.
So as I said, I was on the road with the same the agent that was booking us, was also booking Teenage Head. I reconnected with them, never seen them actually for a long time, and got to know Dave Rave and ended up producing his album. And that was done at Grand Avenue with Dan and people like that. So that album... we were shopping that in New York City. That actually got successful there. That project got going, and I ended up in New York City, and I've been there 21 years now.
Oh, so that's where you live now?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Since 89.
Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing.
So my lesson is you don't plan anything.
And music will take you.
You never know where you're going to end up. So if you don't mind that, you're going to have a lot of fun.
Okay. We've got a break for an ID, and when
okay.
we get back, we'll talk a bit more.
All right.
This is CIUT 89.5 FM, the University of Toronto community radio station. Available across Canada on Star Choice National Satellite Service Channel 826 and broadcasting worldwide at www.ciut.fm.
This is a campus police community advisory alert. A male has been reported exposing himself to females in the area of St. George between Bloor and College Street. The man is described as white, 35 years of age, 5'8", approximately 140 pounds, with short dark hair and small dark eyes with thick eyebrows. He is known to wear a loose-fitting navy blue hooded sweatshirt with the hood up and a navy ribbed toque. If you have any information relating to this person, please contact University of Toronto Campus Police at 416-978-2222.
That's Simply
Someone
Saucer.
Someone should name a book after that.
Yes, they right? should, shouldn't they?
Yeah.
And they did. That's Simply Saucer doing a song called Bulletproof Nothing. That was re-released on the Cyborgs Revisited collection that came out on Sonic Onion not too long ago.
So let's remember that that song was recorded, you know, in 1974, 75. So they had already been doing this stuff. And where would a band like that get booked in Hamilton? This is even, I think Teenage Head were still in the basement
yeah.
at this point.
Yeah. So that was the Daniel Lanois?
One of those songs.
Yeah.
I think the studio's master sound, which is basically the basement, until their mother kicked them out. And that's necessitated yeah. Grand Avenue.
Yeah. All right. So are you still, we were talking initially about living, or when we last were talking, we were talking about living in New York City now. Are you still, mm-hmm. you're still playing in bands down there and still
yep.
recording? It seems
recording,
like
recording, this goofing around as always, nothing's too late now.
right.
I don't know how to do anything else.
Recently you were the editor of Treat Me Like Dirt. At what stage did you get brought in on this book?
I was interviewed very early on in the book. And Liz will tell you that everyone who got interviewed got excited right away and gave her lists of other people to talk to. So I gave her, you know, a list of people, some of which, you know, she couldn't get hold of. About a year later, she contacted me for a follow-up. And then I remember taking her out to Hamilton with Chris Houston. Chris met us there. And Liz realized that Hamilton was an incredibly important part of, if you're going to talk about the hardcore, punk, whatever scene, Hamilton is very important. So Liz realized that right away. Chris emphasized that fact. So we spent a good day out there hanging out. And on the way back, I said, so, you know, there's really going to be a book here if you can put all these interviews together. And it's very easy to start a book, but you should finish the book.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike everyone else. And I've been hearing about people trying to start a book on this subject for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And Liz gets credit. She finished the book.
Yeah, totally.
So that's the most important part, finishing the book.
Yes, it's done.
Right.
Yeah. So at what point did you get brought in to edit the book?
And well, she had been... I had journals from back in the day, which are still in my basement.
Mm-hmm.
And I was checking up dates and trying to fact check wherever possible things that I was physically at, I could confirm dates.
Right.
And for Simply Saucer and the early Rebels in particular, and to a lesser extent Teenage Head, I was hanging around those bands so I could at least say, I don't think this happened this way. You should go back and clarify this or something. My memory is, because I was there at that mm-hmm. point, I don't think this is the chronology properly. So, and then I remember at one point back in the States, she sent me a chapter that she had put together, and I went, well, this is really, really good. And she said, yes, I want it like an oral biography, like Edie, the Edie Sedgwick biography. I think that was her template for the format of the book.
Okay.
And I said, yes, that's, I love that book. I've gone through 3 or 4 copies. So I said, these characters are as good, if not better, than Edie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are good subjects.
Yeah. So does the book then come out as a, in chronological order, because I was wondering that, and it does seem to read like that.
Roughly.
So it sort of peels back in its development, as it develops.
Right. Scene. Because, again, the London, Ontario scene was watching the Hamilton scene in particular, but you have to bring them into the story a bit earlier because some of the Toronto bands were going to London to play. So it's roughly what is that word again?
Chronological.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. So
5 syllables.
Yeah, but there's, I mean, there's a lot of other bands in London, but it did happen a little bit later, it seems.
Right.
At least according to the book, and
I think the important thing is that Toronto was really early on, and as we already discussed, they had to jump even on L.A.
Yeah.
There was, if the L.A. people were watching what was going on here, then that meant we were a little ahead of them. If they were asking how to get a band together, they mustn't have had theirs together yet.
Yeah, that was the clue for sure.
Right.
Yeah. It's, to me, it seems like some of the pig papers were part of the background information. Was that also
mm-hmm.
accurate?
Yeah, whenever there was an interview, because there was a great interview that Freddie and Steven did for, I think it was number 8, the Elvis Costello one too.
Yeah, okay.
And they gave a great interview, and again, we could find out that Freddie had been playing as a folk singer.
Yeah.
When he first got to town.
Yep. Yep.
And I also found out that he had been in one of the last versions of a band in America called the Syndicate of Sound, who did Hey Little Girl, which the Dead Boys covered.
Oh, okay.
So I suddenly realized again, like the Ugly Ducklings we were referencing earlier, I went, okay, we were all collecting the same kind of records, and we're all sort of picking up on the same sort of thing. It's coming out maybe as punk rock now, but we all have that 60s definite garage base to what we were trying to do.
Okay. Do you think also Shades magazine might have been part of the referencing?
Yeah. Now, Shades is very important because that was a... they did a normal-type magazine where they went out and interviewed people and talked about the shows and focused distinctly on this scene and covered the bands and went out to all the gigs. And I'm pretty sure they weren't all in bands themselves, so they had the time, you know, to go to all the gigs. And that was... I couldn't do that, because I wasn't living in Toronto all the time. I was also playing myself, so I'd be gone for a lot.
Yeah.
So I missed a lot.
Yeah, okay.
So Shades was a more... They were very important when we put the book together, because they did a lot of interviews with a lot of people.
Yeah, they totally
right
did.
Right from the beginning.
What about zines like Toronto Punks?
Yeah. Right. They were around the time. I remember them coming out right away, and they would send me the issues. And Pickering Punks... Ever heard of them?
No.
There was a punk magazine in Pickering.
I didn't know.
77, yeah.
Wow.
So everyone was starting to do their little things, because they discovered you could go to the photocopier, and if you were still in school, you could actually use photocopier.
Yeah, get away with the one in school.
Yeah.
How many issues of Pickering Punks?
I've only got one.
Yeah. Okay. Who was in it? And who did it?
Dole Q.
Dole Q.
Dole-Q. Yeah. Have you heard of them?
No.
I've got their cassette. I think it came with the issue. It's really good.
They were a punk band?
I guess so.
Yeah. Okay.
For all intents and purposes this evening, yes, they were punk
band. Were they from Pickering? Or?
I would assume so.
Yeah.
They sounded like
it. Did they ever play Toronto?
Not to my knowledge.
Yeah.
I'm sure they did.
Yeah.
I'm sure they did.
Wow. Do you know who did the zine?
No.
No.
I'd have to go dig it out.
Okay.
But I do remember it.
That's amazing. How much... editorial influence did you have on the writing of the book?
I took out redundant stories when we had a lot of stories about someone getting into a certain fight. I would just take the most colorful version of the fight and put it in. And my job was basically just to, if certain bands are being talked about a lot, those bands got written about a lot. If other bands weren't mentioned a lot by the other people, they wouldn't be as much in the book. And also a very, as I say, a rough chronological order.
Okay.
I think I got the word that time.
Yeah. Chronological. You totally did. It helps explain, though, I mean, because there was some noticeable absences in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it helps explain why some of those absences were there, because they didn't actually get talked about by enough people, I guess.
Right.
Who were being interviewed.
Right. So I would say... there's a lot of bands who continue to promote themselves, which is what they should do. And everyone, of course, has their memory as their bands being very important to them at the time, which is human nature. If a lot of other bands nowadays or over the years have not been remembering you or seeking out your discs or writing about you or asking about you, then maybe your place in this little history may not be as big as you may think it is. And that was reflected in the book.
Okay. I was thinking bands like the Existors were involved in Shades magazine, and
mm-hmm.
they had the band called The Toys, and the Mods were on The Last Pogo.
Right.
And, Tyranna was on the No Pedestrians comp. There was a lot of bands that kind of didn't make it in. It makes me think that there was enough material for another book.
Yeah, there definitely is. Again, my first edit at the book was roughly double the length it is now. And then we went, well, we don't have a huge budget, so Ralph knew, you know, split the columns and squeeze in as much as you can.
Yeah.
But in general, I would just say...
I was saying that you guys did every trick in the book to try and fit content in there, because as a former production manager in a newspaper... the font is small.
Yes.
It's a narrow font. It's in columns, which also helps to get more copy on a page.
Mm-hmm.
and it's 400 pages.
Right.
It's that's kind of insane.
Yeah.
And it took me a long time to read through this book.
There's a lot because it's dense. Remember
no,
the dense?
Not the dense, but they were they were mentioned only a bit in the book too.
Mm-hmm.
But it is dense. I mean, there's a lot of material in there. So
right.
And yet there's absences.
Well, I would say that this is not the first. This is the first book, but it's not the last book in this scene, and. I personally hope there's going to be a lot more books out now for whatever your motivation is. If you're pissed off you weren't in this book enough, then I'm waiting to read your book. Like, get the books out, because this is like this is the opening chapter in the big picture.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of stuff for various reasons that didn't end up in this book, but the stories are there and the stories are valid and everyone's important. You know, just get your book out.
Yeah.
Tell your version of the story as well.
Okay. Do you think Simply Saucer were overrepresented in the book? Because when I listen to Simply Saucer, I think of them as maybe not so punk.
Right. But again, neither were the Dishes or the Cads or Oh Those Pants.
The art school band?
Yeah. So maybe if there was such a thing as an art school in Hamilton, it's sort of, you know, hard to imagine. But Simply Saucer would have been in that
scene. Would have
represented
that school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the other reason Saucer was in there, again, was their house, which was a social center.
Which went on to spawn bands like the Forgotten Rebels.
Right. Yeah. And all the guys in Saucer, Edgar in particular, were always helping out other bands, like telling them where to go to buy your first guitar, how to get rehearsal places. So if only because of that reason, plus the fact that Saucer's remained, you know, people have always stayed, I don't know why, but they've always been interested in their music. That stuff has always been available, either legally or not.
Yeah.
You know, it's people have always been reissuing their stuff and putting, you know, odd stray tracks on comps. And this has been going on for 20, 25, 30 years now. So they've never gone away. I mean, we've all tried to get rid of them, but they won't go away.
No, for sure not. And for good reasons.
Yeah, they were good. I mean, Edgar is a character. And also, you have to remember that from a strictly book point of view, if you were more engaging on the printed page, your stories should be in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than, you know, this is not a reference text, this is a storybook. So someone like Edgar, I mean, he jumped on Ray Davies' back. He's that kind of guy. So he's got a really unique look on the scene, which is as valid as anyone else's. So, and he told it the funniest way. And Mickey is another, you know, he's a brilliant guy. I always said he should do stand-up.
A lot of people seem to say that to him.
I was saying that right from square one, but he was just very loyal to his group.
Yeah.
So he stayed, you know, in the band, but I was always trying to get him just as, you know, he could have been Henry Rollins only.
Yeah.
You know, a quarter of a century earlier.
Yeah, much earlier.
Right.
Okay. If there was to be another edition of this book, who do you think should be included that wasn't?
Everyone that wasn't included in this one.
Okay. So do you think there's like a... do you think there might something like that might come up?
Because, I can't speak for Liz. I don't know if she's up for it right now.
When I was talking to her, she said she had a lot of stuff that didn't make it in.
Yes.
And she was toying, at least. She didn't commit to this. We didn't ask her on air either, but she said that she would try. She was thinking of maybe possibly doing some zines with some of this material.
Right. I think that's how she should approach it.
Yeah.
Again, she's an author. It's nice not to be known as the Toronto punk rock author, because she's just started her career and she's already had books published. And this is by far her most successful, you know, and high profile book.
Yeah. Well, the hope though is that some of these other stories will get told, because a lot of people invested time in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some people are just hoping that their story will get told.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Anyway, I just hope something happens.
I hope so, too. I don't know if a book is the way to do it, but there should at least be a website or something, or a blog or something, to get this stuff up.
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll see what happens with that.
Yeah. I know. There's a lot of stuff being told. I mean, this surface was just scraped with this book.
Yeah, totally. Those are all the questions I had. I appreciate you coming in, especially on such a cold night.
Oh, well. I'm used to cold nights.
Yeah. Is there something you want to hear off the saucer.
Does it have to be simply saucer? What else have we got there?
I've got an Exister's recording here.
Anything?
Yeah? Okay, well, the Exister's are playing next week, and we should get into a show listings when we get back from this. We're going to hear a recording of something that was done last year that is being released next week. And this is a song off that called Think Big. So I just got to get this cued. Here we go. This is the Exister's.
CIUT can now be heard on channel 946 through Rogers Digital Cable.
The great program you enjoy each day on CIUT 89.5 FM is made possible by you. CIUT is listener-supported radio. Visit us online at CIUT.fm.
We're back. It is 11:30. We've got half an hour left in the show, and it's time for show listings. So, first thing is on Friday, the 12th of February, at the Poor Alex. It's a big show with Death Threat, Trapped Under Ice, Revenge, Plus Minus, and Fortune Teller. Following day, and actually, there's something that's not listed here, but I'll mention it as well. This coming Wednesday, which is the 3rd of February?
I'd have to look at a calendar?
Yeah, I don't have a calendar in front of me, but it's a Wednesday, a couple days from now. Today's the 31st, so I think that's the 3rd. At the Bovine... there's a free show with the Blue Demons are going to be playing. Wednesday evening, free at the Bovine on Queen Street. And after that, the show on Friday with Death Threat, Saturday at the Smiling Buddha, it is the Exister's, who you've just listened to, and it's their CD release party. And Mickey Skin from The Curse and Zero from Zero Four will be singing some stuff as well. Sunday the 13th, I guess we've got a typo here. I've got Saturday the 13th and Sunday the 13th. So anyway, Sunday, the day after the Exister's play, there's going to be a show at the Opera House with the Residents. Sunday, February 21st at the Garrison, it is part two of that punk record swap that was supposed to happen last month. And then February 21st, and I think this show actually might have gotten canceled, but the Queers were supposed to play with Off Their Heads, but I heard something about that getting canceled. I don't know if you
heard. I've heard it, but any cancellation, but I could be wrong.
Yeah.
So it's still listed on, I think the Delinquents are supposed to play that show, and it's still listed on their MySpace. So.
Okay. Well, maybe it'll still go on. Monday, February 22nd at the Wrong Bar, 1279 Queen Street West. It is Leatherface, Yesterday's Ring, Lemuria, Sinking Ships, and Summer of 92. And then Saturday, the 27th of February, at Mitzi's Sister, also out in Parkdale, it is The Action from Ottawa. And they're going to be playing. I guess they've gotten back together. Monday, March 15th. At Siesta, we've got Steel Nation, Naysayer, In Time. In Time, that's your band, isn't it?
Yep.
Oh, there you go. All right.
Should be a good show. Everybody come out.
Yeah, come out fun. And see Ed.
There's a chance that we might actually have cassettes of our next release available, but we're still mixing and still have the master of that, so we'll see what happens.
Cassettes or cassette singles?
Cassettes. I don't know.
Do you remember Kasingles? As they used to? Okay.
Plastic cases, no paper sleeves.
All right. Awesome. Old school. Also on that bill, it's Desperate Times. And Friday, March 26th at the Queen Elizabeth Theater at 7 p.m., Henry Rollins is going to roll into town and do his spoken word bit. Saturday, March 27th. And 28th at the Horseshoe, it is the Black Lips with Demon's Claw and the Box Elders. And Friday, May 14th, we're getting into the summertime now, but here's a show to look forward to. It'll be Screeching Weasel with the Roman Line. So I guess Screeching Weasel has gotten back together. And then the next day, the 15th of May, at the Mod Club, the Riverdales, which is... what's his name? Ben Weasel's other band is playing at the Mod Club with Varsity Weirdos and the Creeps. So that's it for the show listings. If you have any shows, if you're in a band or you're promoting a show or you know of a show that you would like to hear about on our show, send us an email at equalizingxdistort@ciut.fm. And you can also check out our blog at... equalizingxdistort.blogspot.com, and we're also on MySpace and Facebook, so look us up and add us to your list, and that's about it. So Ed's going to play some tunes for you now.
Ooh, okay, cool. All right, this is again, you're listening to Equalizing X Distort on CIT 89.5 FM. Lately I've been on a bit of a nerdy clash kick, and I've been obsessed for a while on what the record Cut the Crap could have been, or should have been, or at least have been a listenable record. Here is the song Dictator, played live by The Clash, or Clash Mark II as they were referred to at the time, in 1984. Killing and kill the city, gotta free. Now go.
I love it. cut down to size to get by. You get cut down to size to get by.
Okay, you listen to Equalize and Distort on 89.5 FM CIUT. I'm going to run for this quick because we don't have too many more minutes to play music. Started off the set with the song Dictator, a live version of the horrible song on the horrible record, Cut the Crap. I'm a little obsessed with this lately, so I'll probably be playing some more rarities or different versions of it as I can find them over the next several weeks. Followed by that, we had Rancid with the song Reconciliation, one of the few tracks with Matt Freeman singing, their bass player. Came off their self-titled record from the year 2000. They have more than one self-titled record, but that was their second one. Threw the two in together because that record kind of made me obsessed with Cut the Crap, because that's when Rancid kind of went back to, I guess, their roots. And that's what the Clash exactly were supposed to do with Cut the Crap, but horribly failed to do so. Followed by that, we had Go Van Go by the Delinquents off the record Live Your Life Like It's Stolen. It was self-released. And then we had a bit of a slower song than what's usually played at Equalize and Distort with the song Danforth and Maine by Horses. Comes out the song off the record Brotherly Love from Juicebox Recordings. That features members of other bands like Fortune Teller and Attention. So I guess some punk rockers doing a little bit more rock and roll there. Up next, are we doing a demo feature, Rob? Or are we? No. Okay, so Rob's got some more music for you. I'm going to throw it over to him.
Thank you very much. Yeah, we've got about 10 minutes left in the set. And I've got a little mix of things, no real theme. Yeah, and it's going to be the red one. So starting off with a song by Mud, who was a band from late 80s, early 90s, a local Toronto band, and this song is called Iced Tea.
Of winning.
That was No Mind with a song called Checking the Obituaries, and that's from their LP, which came out in 88, called Tales of Ordinary Madness. And that was on Lone Wolf Records out of Oakville, Ontario. And before that, it was... It was AOD, Adrenaline OD. And that was a song called Bugs from the album Humongous Fungus Among Us from New Jersey on Bayer Records, and that one came out in 1986. And before that, it was Infest with a song called Where's the Unity, and that's from a bootleg 7-inch. And the first song was by Mud from Toronto, and that's the song's called Iced Tea, and that's from a compilation 7-inch called This Ain't the Hot.